Okay, so good evening, everyone. Can everyone hear me? Is this kind of level okay? Okay. Yes, please. Yeah. Okay, so we've got, from what I understand, we've got roughly 1 hour to do this. So it's kind of two ways we can do it. 50 minutes. Okay. Okay. Well. Like, let's say Greek 50 Greek minutes. So we can either do there's a presentation that I'm going to do on the Greek rites that you can't really avoid. I think that's going to be part of the plan no matter what. But after that, we can either kind of do questions and answers, or if people don't really have that much to ask, we can just show. There's a short documentary that has just come out from a group in Thessaloniki in northern Greece, kind of documenting the revolt, which is about half an hour long, so maybe we'll screen that. But that's something that we can decide on the end of the talk, like depending on what people feel like doing. Okay, so what I'm going to do, what I'm here to do is, I think, is to give a kind of eyewitness account of the events of December, what happened down there in Greece. But the way I actually want to start this off is by saying, talking about one of the things that kind of mostly impressed me and kind of like depressed me at the same time while I was there, as soon as I got in Greece, I kind of realized the people who were actually involved in the revolt and who I was like in contact with generally considered me to be quite old. So this is something people kept referring to, especially, you know, when I like talked about things like Genoa and stuff, people were just like, you know, you're a different generation, man, you know, the previous generation. Which is quite shocking, because I thought, you know, still think I'm fairly young. But it also kind of made me start thinking about, you know, okay, my generation, okay, we're a different generation, what is my generation? And kind of started thinking that we are actually a different generation. My generation was the one who kind of grew up in the late 80s and kind of like through the 90s. And these are, as I'm sure people in this city and in this country know only too well, these are the really dark years of like neoliberal, like kind of there is no alternative kind of times. And we seem to like endlessly be like kind of jumping from one defeat to the other, like kept fighting, like taking one struggle on after the other, and kept like losing quite spectacularly every single one of them, it seemed. So just before moving out of Greece, I was quite involved in this high school students movement, which right at the end of the 90s, between 98 and 99, opposing an education reform bill. We basically occupied about 90% of the high schools in the country and kept them under our control for about 2 months. The result was that the bill passed unchanged. Before us, in 1991, a similar, equally big, maybe even bigger wave of occupations had its own dead. There was a high school teacher, Nikos Teboneras, who was actually assassinated in my hometown, in Patras, defending his high school, which was occupied by its students. And he was assassinated by right-wing thugs who were attacking the school. Even before these people, a few years before that, in 1985, another 15-year-old was Michalis Kaltezas, was assassinated again by the police while outside the Athens Polytechnic on November 17th. And November 17th is important because it's the day that commemorates the student uprising of 1973. You'll notice I keep going back. In 1973, the students of the Athens gathered in the Athens Polytechnic in one of the biggest kind of like protests against the dictatorship in the country that was going on at that time. And the school was stormed by military, by forces of the dictatorship, killing scores of students, at least in the tens, if not in the hundreds. Many people think that, like, this is a generation of my parents, and you've got stories from them saying that their own parents, while they were in the Polytechnic, they must have been really worried, but they must have also thought their own time of revolt, which was back in 1944, and that's December 1944, in the so-called December events, where what basically happened is that for about 37 days, you had a full-scale revolt going on in Athens, where on the one hand you had the left-wing guerrillas of the Communist Party and lots of like a popular resistance, and on the other hand you had British army troops lining up with the government troops and fascists. And the reason why I wanted to do all this kind of like rewind back into the Greece's recent history is because what happened then, and it kind of nicely ties up because it was another December, what happened in that December is very similar to what we saw this December in Greece. Many people have been saying that, and I think they're absolutely right in that what you had at that time, where you basically had the, you know, vaguely the progressive sort of forces, the lefty and kind of like people on the one side, and then when you had the fascist and the military on the other, was in a way, you know, if not repeated, at least you can see many similarities between what happened then and what happened now. Another reason why this is a really important thing to mention is because that answers a question that many people in this country have, and lesser so maybe in Greece, which is, what does your average person on the street think of the revolt? You know, they say, okay, this is all good and fair, you know, you've got your point, but what does the average person think, you know, you're up? And the answer is simply there's not really an average person on the street. Like, it's a very divided society, maybe in a kind of similar way that the British society is divided on a kind of class line, you know? But there it's a more kind of like political division, you know, you're either like to the left or to the right, and that runs through families. So what happened here in December, more than anything else, was for this kind of divide to kind of resurface, you know, and to kind of pose this question again, you know, you're either for us or against us, you're either for the revolt or against it. There's not really much of a middle ground. Now, having said all of that, after the revolt has happened, right now, it's quite easy to make these linkages and to realize how much of a political divided society the Greek one is. But while it was actually happening, these are tensions that had been like under the surface for quite a while, you know, and the Greek society was a very, and still is in many ways, a very kind of like typical Western European society where it all seems like fairly good and fair. So obviously myself, along with many others, were really shocked when we heard of not so much about Alexandros' assassination, because this is anything but an isolated incident. You know, the cops in Greece do shoot and kill systematically. It's just that this time, you know, it was, for them, the wrong person at the wrong time and at the wrong place kind of thing, but they assassinated. But it's by no means like an isolated event as they tried to present it. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is that when the revolt kicked off, I was outside Greece. I started receiving text messages. The first text message I received on the first day was saying, get on the first flight back here. I thought, okay, that's kind of weird, that's kind of bizarre, you know. Never have really received anything like this. But I kind of ignored it for the moment. I realized there was something fairly big going on. Then on day number two, there was another text saying, come back while you can. Like, fly back, get on the flight while there's still flights coming in the country, basically. I kind of realized that, you know, it was even more important. And then on day number three, there was a text saying the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry of Finance are on fire and people have just stormed a gun shop in central Athens. And I was like, okay, all right, you know, it's made it quite clear what to do. And at that moment, which was December 9th, I kind of caught myself in the kind of a race to get back into the country before the borders are closed off, basically, because the rumor was that the government was about to call for a state of an exception, a state of an emergency, which would have meant that most likely the borders, you know, would be closed. So finding yourself into like a race to getting back into the country while you can is not your kind of typical way of going back home for Christmas, you know. But still, you know, so, you know, flew into the country on the day of Alexandros' funeral. So that was day four. The first 3 days were the days of a very heavy writing. This was the morning of day four, the morning of the funeral. Fleeing, not knowing what to expect, although things got pretty clear straight away. Like, I think I was tear gassed half an hour after I had flown in the country, like literally flying in, going to the main square and being tear gassed straight away. And the next 3 weeks were, it's a very, very difficult to even like start to describe. to describe like what these moments were like, because it was, I mean, I keep telling this to people, it was the closest I've ever lived to a revolutionary condition, which is not as impressive as it sounds, because obviously I haven't really lived that close to a revolution, obviously, like most of us. But still, I mean, it was completely, you know, exceptional and like as far away as from normality as we can possibly imagine, you know, like walking down Exarchia, which is the area where it all kind of like started off. On the first day, there was no cars, because the main kind of roads leading into the area were blocked off by barricades. There was absolutely no cars, only pedestrians. Of course, no cops to be seen. There was not a single big store that wasn't smashed up and or burnt in Exarchia on day number three. It was literally, and you know, people asked, why did the like kind of like this first stage of the revolt end? This was simply because people ran out of targets. It's not an exaggeration. Like the whole of Central Athens had all its, you know, big kind of like multinational stores and banks like smashed up. So there was not much more to go on there. What happened after that for the next 2 weeks, roughly, like so, say from the 9th of December up to just before Christmas. There was a few thousand, I mean, it's really hard to try and calculate how many people there was. I don't know if it's even that important, but basically a few thousands who joined in what was effectively the anarchist occupations. So the three main universities in Athens, which are the School of Economics, the Law School, and of course the Polytechnic, which also has a really, you know, big historical significance. They're all occupied by anarchist assemblies, different anarchist assemblies. Who would run them on an everyday basis. Now, to even conceptualize what that is, I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I basically went where my friends were, where people, and I'm sure many people did the same, just like headed for where there were people who I knew. And that was the School of Economics, which is a university of, you know, about 10,000 students. It's a fairly big university. And it was under the anarchist control for about just under 3 weeks. Which means every single thing in the building, from the printing press to the restaurant to every single office, were in our hands. That, of course, meant that we took advantage of it pretty early on. There was this particular occupation kind of took upon itself the role of like the media, kind of like counter media, like trying to put out the word about the revolt. So we had a newspaper published in the university, which was, it wasn't a very imaginative name, but it was also called Revolt, which was also printed under the direct and exclusive sponsorship of the university. Of course, the university not knowing anything about that. We printed about, I think we did three issues of about 5,000 to 10,000 copies each, of like a full kind of newspaper that was given out to the streets of Athens. So that was what was going on in the School of Economics. Like, we were basically running the university on an everyday basis. We would have about, say, 1,000 to 2,000 people going in and out of the building every day. We had the daily assembly of about 800, which was as chaotic as it sounds. You would basically have an assembly, yeah, starting at about 10 p.m. and ending in some ridiculous hour in the morning, where people would kind of like try to understand what happened in the day and kind of like try and decide what would do the day after. Not always that successfully, you know, but we did try. One of the things I didn't really expect to go through, or rather one of the things I did expect, like having gone to quite a few of the like counter summits, like maybe many of you in this room have as well. Although I don't know anymore, because like I said, we're the previous generation. But so in a counter summit, you know, as intense as and fairly unpredictable as it is, there is a kind of a vague plan. You know the set dates, you know where you're going, you know what you're kind of like supposed to do or not do. You decide what you're going to do or not do. You do it, you go back, hopefully. The situation in Greece for these roughly 3 weeks felt a bit like a counter summit, only much, much bigger and with absolutely no plan and what idea for what's coming up next. So every single day that you would be there, you were like, you had no idea what's what's coming. You know, it could be anything from the army on the streets to, you know, fuck knows what. And this was a really, really weird feeling. And the feeling was that also everyone else on the streets was expecting the kind of same kind of thing. So walking around central Athens, for example, over those days, you could kind of sense that there was no... I felt that especially very strongly, like the first day. I was like, okay, if a cop stopped me now, you know, there's absolutely no way you can kind of like fake it or kind of like, you know, find any like any kind of excuse for what, you know, what I'm doing or where I'm going. You know, it was very obvious that whoever was on the streets those days was there for a reason. You know, where again, you were there to defend the revolt or you were there to like attack it. You know, you were there. There was really no middle ground. There was no just kind of like passers-by, which was a very, very strange feeling for a city to have for these, like, you know, 3 weeks. And of course, the revolt happened right in the city center. So, you know, the three universities basically kind of form a triangle that kind of like goes around the city center. So here it would be something like, you know, having the area between the universities, the train station and the coach station. You know, it doesn't get more central than that. Like the main kind of like rioting street is the equivalent of like Tottenham Court Road in London, which is the kind of like high tech, you know, like if you want a laptop in Athens, it's the same street that you would go if you want to fight the police, basically. This is quite bizarre. So this is what, this was kind of like the kind of like, say, anarchist involvement in the revolt. But what I really want to stress out here is that the anarchist role or the anarchist involvement in the revolt wasn't even that important. It wasn't, the anarchists were not the biggest part of what was happening down there. You know, if you say, if we really have to talk with numbers and say that, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 anarchists, maybe, I don't know, 5,000 were active those days in the streets of Athens. The people who were out there, like, participating in the revolt were between, anything between 10,000 and 30,000, so it was massive, and were just like a part, small part of that. The biggest part was definitely the high school students, which were absolutely amazing. Like, it was just like, you know, totally like an honor to be like next to them on the streets. It was just absolutely incredible. And massive migrant communities, which again, and that's extremely important because the migrant community in Greece is relatively new, and this is the first kind of time that it participates in a mass kind of event like this one. So these were the kind of like three main groups, very different, you know, very kind of little to have in common before. And one of the really, really interesting things that came out of this kind of like, say, street coexistence, if you can call it this, is a kind of sense of like, you know, having not one consciousness, but trying to develop a common kind of consciousness. You know, at no point did I at least personally feel that, you know, I wanted something else from these people or that we had anything to kind of like, any kind of major disagreement. Like the people who were participating in this revolt would kind of decide almost like having like a collective consciousness. So I really wanted to mention this because I want to like fight back against this argument that said that Greece's revolt had no kind of like political context, or, you know, that people didn't really have any political arguments. There was nothing concretely kind of political that came out of this. I think the reality is exactly the opposite. You know, it was basically people out there saying, you know, we want absolutely nothing to do with parliamentary politics anymore. We really couldn't care less if this government stays or falls, because we know the governments are exactly the same. You know, it was the previous government that killed the previous 15-year-old, etc., etc. You know, people realize nothing changes on that level, and people, rather than having a demand, like a kind of abstract demand, like there was some voices saying, you know, calling for the disarmament of the police, for example, you know, had some kind of like sort of mediation. But most people didn't even kind of like, wouldn't even bother to talk to the politicians anymore. You know, it's like, we're out on the streets now, we want change, and we're going to make change. You know, we're not going to ask you for anything, we're going to take what's ours, kind of thing. So when the police attacked, you know, people occupied the universities and kind of said, these are our bases, because, yeah, I have to mention this, the police are not allowed in the universities in Greece under the law. It's the so-called academic asylum law that protects universities in the name of academic freedom, which is a direct product of the struggle of the students in 1973. So you can kind of see how these all link up. So, you know, when people were attacked by the police, they went into the universities, they claimed them, they said, these are our spaces now. So they use them as kind of basis from which to continue the revolt. You know, when the media lied about the revolt, people occupied the journalist trade union headquarters and kind of like started doing grassroots like counter media campaigns from within the building. When the main kind of like reformist trade union, kind of a TUC equivalent in Greece, refused to call for a general strike, then like people occupied their headquarters and again held them for a good few weeks. You know, this was a kind of direct kind of like response. It was like, if you know, if you hurt us, we're gonna like attack. You know, it was and there's something I kind of very briefly mentioned in the afternoon as well, the case of Konstantina Kuneva, which is this Konstantina is this militant trade unionist, is a grassroots trade unionist from Bulgaria. She's a worker in Athens, a migrant worker. And 17 days into the revolt, she was attacked on her way back from work. Two people stopped her and threw acid, it's called sulfuric acid, threw her acid on her face and forced her to drink some of it. So they basically left her half blind. She might be able to get some of her eyesight back in one of her eyes, but she's half blind and with like serious kind of eating problems as well. And the reason why Konstantina was attacked is because she was, you know, she had all these roles assigned to her from the society. You know, she was the woman, the migrant, the low wage, kind of like precarious worker. And she refused these, of course. She kind of like challenged them by becoming a grassroots syndicalist and like demanding, you know, fighting back. So like I said in the afternoon, her case in itself is not that exceptional. And by this, I mean, of course, it's tragic, it's barbaric, it's incredible that this happened, but it's not, again, an isolated incident. I'm sure there's many more happening that we just don't hear about. But what was exceptional was the wave of solidarity that kind of like grew around Konstantina's case and that has been kind of supporting her since, you know. So as soon as this happened, she was working for a subcontracting company that kind of works for the Athens Railway. So people occupied the headquarters of Athens Railway in response, you know, so again, directly making the link and, you know, showing who's responsible and showing how they're going to take action. And then exactly 1 month after the attack, there was a demonstration in central Athens called just by like basically grassroots trade unions, anarchists and small lefty groups, and about 10,000 people took the streets in solidarity with her. And this is not something that would have happened before, and this is not something that would have happened without the revolt. You know, before this, there might have been a few hundreds, if they were lucky, maybe up to 1,000 people for a case like this. But now, what people have realized is that, you know, they have to fight back. You know, there's one of the slogans of the revolt says, let us leave nothing unanswered no more, kind of thing. So whenever we feel we're being threatened or being attacked, we're going to fight back. And this is what's happening. This is one of the legacies. I don't know if there's much point in continuing. I can say... I'd like to mention, yeah, the other thing is about the prisoners of the revolt, sorry. It's the last thing, and then I'm going to open up to questions and answers, because I guess it's more important to hear what you want to hear, or what I want to say. So there was many, you know, like a revolt like this, such a big threat to the state, to the Greek state, and to the kind of like existing order, couldn't really go unanswered. So during the revolt itself, there was hundreds of like prosecutions, many arrests, and many people are now in pre-trial detention. Which what this is, in Greece, by law, you can be arrested and detained for up to 18 months without a trial. So, you know, what is the talk in this country? I think they're thinking of taking up to, 60 days or something under the Anti-Terrorist Act, and that's already outrageous. Of course it is. But this is what happened. In many cases and in many cities, people were actually charged under the Anti-Terrorist Act, so trying to, like, for whatever reason, make a link with that. So there's about, I think there's just over 60 people. I'm not even quite sure exactly how many. I think there's 67, but I might be wrong. There's definitely more than 60 people who are now in pretrial detention in Greece. So of course, you know, keeping up the struggle for them is really important. You know, this is one of the main things, one of the main kind of like elements that people have taken on. This is the reason why tonight is also a benefit for these prisoners. There's also a card signing, is that right? There's cards for everyone to sign next door. This would be actually really nice because this is not really a tradition that we have in Greece, like signing cards in public events. And I think this would something that would really make kind of impact and like something people would probably like back there. These are the things I want to... Only one last thing I also mentioned in the afternoon, and then I'm going to stop, I promise. But in terms of this, in terms of the state's response, and the state and also like the kind of broader kind of order, but, and I would include the fascists into this. Last Tuesday, so that's what, 5 days ago, there's this kind of lefty social center kind of space in central Athens, in the area where the revolt started from, which is the traditional kind of lefty and anarchist area in Athens. And it has this space that's basically used by some lefty groups and some migrant groups. It's called the, you could call it a migrant's place. And this, on Tuesday night, they were having a meeting inside, or having a public meeting, and someone walked up to the window and tried to throw a hand grenade through the window. Luckily, for the people inside, the hand grenade broke. It was a double glazed window. It only broke the first layer, and it bounced back and it exploded outside. But of course, if it had gone through the window, like it's not very hard to imagine what would have happened. This went completely unreported in the media. It's stunning to see how silent were the Greek and the international media were about this. Not a single word, and even those very few ones who mentioned it kind of tried to imply that maybe it was anarchists attacking the lefties or some lefties attacking the other lefties, which is completely rubbish. This is like what the police kind of like tried to circulate as a scenario. So it was a fascist attack. The license plates of the car were unregistered, which in Greece means that they basically, the car belongs to the police. They're the only ones who have unregistered license plates. So it's very obvious who did it and for what reason. You know, they're trying new tactics. They're trying to escalate the tension because they know there's no coming back. They know they're playing in a new kind of like terrain. You know, this is, but they can't use their old tactics, and they're trying to find new kind of ways of dealing with this movement, with the revolt and what's left behind. And I guess a big kind of like bet, a big kind of effort for us has to be to also find new ways of playing into this game. I think now we have a big advantage. You know, what the legacy of the revolt is massive, but we just have to find a way of like kind of spreading it into the everyday, into making it more permanent. So I'm just going to leave it to this.